First, I would like to thank our lecture sponsor, Gazette Newspapers. Tonight, we will be exploring Baja's Sea of Cortez. As you may know, this is one of the most important wildlife havens in all the world, and I've been lucky enough to experience it firsthand. San Ignacio's Lagoon in Baja is a special place where gray whales go to give birth to their calves. And they're curious about people. In fact, it's a very special place where these animals will actually come up to you while you're in the small pongas or boats. The aquarium is offering a trip to experience this firsthand at the end of February. And if you're interested, Teresa is here, and she'd be happy to tell you more after this evening's lecture. I'm pleased to welcome Aaron Quinintar. He's going to discuss the environmental impacts and lost conservation opportunities in Baja California and the Sea of Cortez from 1994 to 2008. Quinintar first traveled to Baja California Peninsula with his parents during the winter of 1969 and 1970. And I heard some of his stories earlier. It was quite a treacherous adventure to get there during that time without gas stations throughout the area and very bumpy roads. He was a lifeguard in San Diego for 25 years, and he has helped establish lifeguard agencies in Tijuana, Ensenada, Punta Abre Ojos, and Todos Santos. From 2000 to 2005, he led conservation efforts with the conservation organization Wild Coast, or Costa Salvaje. During this period, he led a team working to protect Bahía Concepción, Laguna San Ignacio, and Bahía de Los Angeles from large-scale development and industrialization efforts. In 2002, Quinintar and attorney Rodrigo Jara filed a successful legal challenge against a project calling for the construction of 27 resort marinas on both sides of the Baja California Peninsula. From 2006 to 2007, Quinintar structured an innovative new conservation model designed to protect the Midriff Island region of the Sea of Cortez. And now it is my great honor to introduce Aaron Quinintar.
Thank you, Marilyn. Thank you, Marilyn. I'd like to first extend a thank you to the aquarium for hosting and for everybody here that's attending and that's watching on the live stream. As Marilyn said, she already went through my title of my discussion, and I focus on environmental impacts, especially on coastal and peninsular lands in 1998 to 2008. But before I do that, I'd first like to extend a heartfelt congratulations and felicidades to the Grupo Tortuguero of the Californias, the Sea Turtle Working Group of the Californias, these frontline organizations. Thanks to their hard work over these 15 years, sea turtles are showing signs of recovery in both the Gulf and the Eastern Pacific Coast. So a heartfelt abrazo to Jay Nichols and everybody there. They just celebrated their 15-year anniversary. Great work, guys. A little bit about me. I was born and raised in San Diego, California, to a family that extends from Southern California into Baja, with family in Tijuana, Ensenada, Mexicali in the north, and in the south, Todos Santos and La Paz. The other thing I've been fortunate enough to do is over 25 years, I've been fortunate enough to make over 600 rescues on Southern California beaches, and then also take the skills that I have and the friends that I have in the lifeguarding community and extend this training, these concepts, and saving lives throughout the peninsula. We're doing some great work through this organization, the International Surf Life Saving Association. So on to the discussion. The Baja Peninsula, as Marilyn was saying, is recognized as one of the most important biomass and biodiversity areas on the planet. One of the great difficulties and benefits is that it essentially works as a giant fish trap. The other thing that you notice is that as a large marine environment, despite being categorized that way, it has significant amounts of coastline. So the nexus between coastal areas and the Gulf itself are vitally important. And the Gulf is divided. I saw that the exhibit here divides the Gulf into three areas. I divide the Gulf into four, with the Upper Gulf, the Midriff Island region, Central Coast, and then the Southern Gulf down here. Just a bit of a difference, but thought I'd mention that. So what is conservation? How do you go about it? What's its goal? For me, it's permanently protecting and enhancing natural ecosystem processes. Easy enough, sounds easy enough, but when you go into the real world and when you go to Mexico and Baja California, things get extremely complicated. One of those is Mexico's own history. A 70-year rule by the PRI led to extensive corruption and inefficiency in government and government agencies, a distrust by outlying states and people to their institutions. And this translates into fishing agencies as well and conservation agencies, which in effect are government agencies. Another thing that's very important to note as a complicating factor is poverty. In 2005, UN published data indicating that in Mexico, extreme poverty, people making less than $2 a day, accounted for 40% of the Mexican population. That's nearly 40 million people. Just to give you an example of how complicated that situation is, when Haiti imploded, the percentage of people making less than $2 a day was 70. So 40 is a lot closer to 70 than it is to zero. And the other thing that happens due to poverty is that anywhere there's strong economic activity, people from other parts of Mexico move to those areas in search of a better life and jobs. The other thing that happens is in the post 9/11 world, the US begins really kind of strengthening and fortifying their borders, and this bottles up a safety valve for Mexico. Leads to more poverty, more folks in desperation, potentially turning to illegal activity and narco trafficking. And so a very, very complicated situation. On top of that, and I'll talk briefly about, is the system of land tenure. It became a very important issue in conservation during the period that I focus on. And for my job as a conservationist is to listen to scientists. There's a lot of great data coming out all over the Gulf, all over the peninsula and coastal areas and the mountain ranges and how these things affect. And my job is to take that science, those facts, areas of concern, and structure strategies. Another complicated scenario because I have to work within the Mexican legal system, work with fellow NGOs, and then also work with the foundations in funding. Because when you go into these projects, you have this dream of permanently enhancing and protecting natural ecosystem processes, but the real world sometimes doesn't do that. So on to the Sea of Cortez and its impacts over the decades. In the 1930s, commercial fishing really begins to ramp up. And what happens is foreign and domestic fleets start moving in, and the trawlers immediately start having massive disruptions with bottom disruptions. If you've never seen a trawl net, what they do is they drag a chain right in front of the net. As the shrimp jump, they get caught in the net, but what's left behind is this massive disruption to bottom. Sometimes it takes 50, 60 years to recover. The other interesting data is 200,000 tons of bycatch for every 30,000 tons of shrimp. That's an indicator of a large marine environment teeming with life. And unfortunately, those 200,000 tons would be thrown overboard and wasted for years and years and years to come. In 1935, the Colorado River Delta is dammed, immediately having a negative impact in the upper delta, in the big wetland complex at the northern end of the Sea of Cortez. The impact has been so severe over the years. The last data that I saw indicated 8 to 10% of the original surface area of that wetland. Massive hit. And the other thing that was interesting during this time was there was a dedicated shark fishery by artisanal fishers. During May and September, there would be an annual migration from south to north up the Gulf, and local fishers and pongas in working nearshore waters would work for this period. And the rest of the year, they would work as fishing for subsistence. And the Tatuaba becomes an issue. And if you visited the site upstairs, it becomes targeted. In 1940s, we get the cruise aboard the Western Flyer with John Steinbeck and Ed Ricketts. If you haven't read this book, please do so. It's fantastic. And the thing that's interesting about the book, even though it's a narrative, a lot of scientists are using it and conservationists are using it now as a baseline. What was there in 1940? And the descriptions are always teeming with life, incredible amounts of biomass. They describe great schools of tuna. And the one thing that happens here is that there's no jumbo squid. Now, throughout the Gulf and the Pacific side, there's massive amounts of Humboldt squid. It's pretty clear that these guys, especially Ricketts, who's a trained biologist, should have made notice at some point either in his notes, the data, or the book. It doesn't happen, and it could be a serious indicator of a break in the food web. Japanese trawlers begin to start plying the Gulf, and this is the point where commercial fishing really begins to take off on a large scale. The boats are getting bigger, displacement's getting bigger, and you get massive amounts of bycatch. And from mid-1940s on to 1970, landings would increase. From about the 1920s to mid-1940s, there was a very vibrant black-lipped pearl oyster fishery located in La Paz on the Sea of Cortez, the southern end of the Sea of Cortez. That collapses. And now Totuaba, the fishing effort is shifting, and they're using gill nets, and ultimately they're dropping in sticks of dynamite to take them out. By the 60s and 70s, you get apex predators start to decline. And the purse seiners shift fishing effort. One thing that's very important about taking a look at fishers is when you see this movement in fishing effort, it's an indicator. It means something's wrong. Their targets are gone, and they're changing up their target species. The shrimp fishery's overfished. By this point, they've peaked, and they start declining. The Totuaba's also numbers falling fast. And coincidentally, also with that, anywhere that in the range of Totuaba's, fishermen would basically target Totuaba's based on where they saw a vaquita. If you saw a vaquita pop up, fishermen, artisanal fisher, that's where gill nets would go. And both of them would be taken out in large numbers. And the pongas, the small artisanal guys, are using nearshore fishers. They're all staying close to their villages and small fishing communities. By the 1980s, we're down to 500 in the vaquita. In 1983, in response, the Mexican government declares the Upper Gulf Biosphere Reserve. Big problem there was that when the biosphere is reserved, it comprises of three main areas, a core area. This is where the things that you want to protect are located, the habitat of them, and then buffer areas, and then other areas that they can either call sustainable fisheries areas. But the core area itself, with regards to the vaquita habitat, only accounted for just under 40% of its habitat. So you had a lot of fishing activity around the edges that were still impacting both vaquita and Totuaba. During this period, there's 15,000 pongas working the Sea of Cortez and the Pacific side of the peninsula. And by now, the nearshore fisheries to their villages and communities are done. They're starting to move. They're starting to fan out into different areas. And the big boys, commercial fishers, utilizing 70 to 90 ton displacement boats, are setting gill nets 2 miles long, massive amounts of bycatch, turtles, mantas, sharks. And ultimately what happens during this period is the local artisanal guys, in desperation, they're going further and further away from their nearshore fisheries areas, begin to turn to hookah. And it's basically a compressor onto a mask. It allows for a diver to stay down for hours and hours because he's breathing air from the atmosphere. So you don't get any issues with decompression sickness or anything. What the divers would do is they would strategically set nets and basically herd the remaining reef fish into the net. 1,000 kilos per night. When that starts to dry up, you get the pistoletos. You get guys, and there's a picture down here of a pistoletto, basically cherry-picking the last of the reef fish. The data that I have, the estimation is 2002, 1,000 tons. So big hits. By 2000 into 2010, thanks to the great work of Jay Nichols again and the Grupo Tortuguero and a whole host of volunteers, we span out throughout the peninsula and the Gulf region. And we estimate that approximately 25,000 turtles are being caught as bycatch for an illegal trade, black market, and big staggering number, big staggering number. High trophic species are beginning to decline, and in response, you get low trophic species up. By this time, shrimpers are done. In a six-month period that they were allowed to trawl, they're only pulling in 7 tons of shrimp. It is over. And that sets up this very interesting dilemma because you still have these guys that are fishermen, and they need to do some work. Mexico accounts for that, and in one example, in response to the situation in declining populations of shark. There's a shark norma, 029 of Mexico's fisheries law is passed. And the shark norma and other laws like it, when fishers are converting to long line, it allows these fishers, commercial fishers, to commercialize their bycatch. And this sets up this very interesting dilemma because their target species are in dramatic decline, and yet they've got that little loophole that allows them to commercialize bycatch. And so what these guys do is they'll go set right near big schools of Dorado, right near schools of billfish. It's a very, very serious situation. And the five species you see there are the ones that are restricted under Article 68 of Mexican fisheries laws to sport fish. And the other thing that's an important statistic about that is in terms of the billfish, it's estimated that each billfish that is caught in sport fishing industry leaves from anywhere from $1,000 to $1,200 in the local community. You got guys have to fly down there, they stay in hotels, they eat in restaurants. And a lot of times what happens is a lot of these fish are catch and release. So it's this kind of sustainable way of moving. But you still have to account for these families or the artisanal fishers, and it sets up this very, very interesting, complicated problem. But with terms of Dorado, in 2010, you get 9,000 tons illegally imported into the United States. The reason I know that is right now I'm trying to gather some support along with a gentleman, very brave individual and fantastic guy, Vince Raddis of Guaymas, who's raised this issue. We're trying to get support to address it and hope something comes up. So what does it mean for the Gulf? It's like any time we've seen these dramatic shifts in fishing effort, indicating trouble. It always indicates trouble. If you'd like to see more about Vince, go to YouTube and punch in A Fish Made of Gold or Oro de Cortez. The first one was a documentary made by Telasa Television, French television, and the other one is YouTube that Vince self-produced. Lays out some very heavy stuff about illegal fishing and the importation of that fish into the United States. But overall, like when you talk to fishers, I've spent a lot of time at all levels, from local fishing guys, from independents, to big commercial fishers. And these guys get it. They understand. And the problem is that they understand that in Mexico, good functioning cooperatives work. That means dedicated access, areas where a fishing community working with biologists, universities, fisheries managers, can set up catch limits, dedicated, and so you can set up sustainable fisheries. The problem with this is that the problem is so complicated where you have all these actors working against each other, the environmental groups working against the fishers working against the government, everybody working against each other. And the final arbiter, if something's going to happen here, it's going to have to be led by the environmental community helping the government reform, get their act together. Because in the end, it's going to be the government that has to be the enforcer and fair arbiter of Mexican fisheries law. So onto the land. It's a very tenuous situation. And what this sets up over these decades is that when you have a depleted fishery, as I talked about earlier, that there's a lot of coastline in the Sea of Cortez, that makes coastal areas even more vitally important. Those nexus, those nesting beaches, those wetlands become vitally, vitally important in the process. I love this quote because ever since I was a little kid, I used to think this. I would go to travel in Baja, and unfortunately, wherever I saw a big city, I also saw environmental impacts. It's just the reality. Even here in the States, it's the same thing. And so one of the goals that I had as I moved into conservation was to allow the existing cities to continue to grow. And these outlying areas, these coastal areas that are extremely valuable and a place where Sea of Cortez and the peninsula are exchanging a lot of energy, food, nutrients, nurseries, protect those things at all costs. And this quote comes from, I was fortunate enough to travel to Loreto in 2005 with a family foundation that was interested in supporting National Marine Park in Loreto. And we met with the folks from Grupo Ecologista Antares and a gentleman named Fernando Arcas, their president. He's like the Jacques Cousteau of Baja, like brilliant guy, like you'd love him. And Rodolfo was on as part of the team. And quiet guy, he owns one of the rental car agencies in Loreto. And it's his economic interest to have more build out, more tourists, more development. But he says this, He understands it. He understands that we need to protect these outlying areas. So in order to understand that, I talked about land tenure and the complicated issue that it is. In 1910, Mexico enters into a revolution that would last 7 years. And one of the principal drivers of the Mexican Revolution is the call for land redistribution. And in 1935, under President Lázaro Cárdenas, in Article 27 of the Mexican Constitution, land reform begins under a newly formed federal agency called Reforma Agraria. And the interesting thing that happens is the way that these land cooperatives or these ejidos are structured is that they make these rural communities, these groups of citizens out in this field, including all of Baja, 97% of Baja's ejido land. They allow them exclusive possession and control of these of each of these communal land areas, but they don't allow them to encumber. They retain subsurface and air mineral and air rights to the federal government. So what it does is it makes these communities land rich, cash poor. So even in areas that had high agricultural potential, these communities couldn't go to a bank and raise capital. This is 1935. The Partido Revolucionario Institucional is just now taking hold. And what happens is it creates this tribute system. So the government, all these communities, especially in Baja, in this kind of very arid areas, become dependent on the government for outboard motors, for agricultural seed, tractors. Everything comes as a gift from the government. And so it becomes this very heavy patronage system. And the interesting thing that it does classic environmental side is it locks these lands up, essentially. The big changes to Article 27 happened in 1992 and again in 1997. And during this time in 92, they allow for long-term leases. In 97, they allow these ejidos to begin selling their land in fee. So this kind of opens a door. Some early folks go in there and start cutting deals with these communities. And the interesting thing about these land cooperatives that are all over Mexico is that it provides me as a conservationist a direct route to landowners to set up conservation structures. We can come up with these agreements that are superior to Mexican law, Mexican environmental law. And the thing that's great about it is we deal directly with the landowners. And so what does it look like? What is an ejido? So I use the same picture, and here Emiliano Zapata wins the coin toss, and he goes, I want that little corner lot. Pancho Villa says, I want number two. This gentleman here says, picks the third parcel. This gentleman sitting down here with the bandana sits over here at number four. And then everything else is the commons. And later on, they decide to add this guy here. And he doesn't have a parcel. He doesn't have his own land. But he's a member. He has a 1/5 interest in these commons. They have a common ownership over the commons. The other thing you see is all of the rabble back here, they all live in the town. And in the ejidos, in areas that are zoned for town, they're outside of this ejido system. The other thing you find on the maps are these DP, dominio pleno. These are fee title properties. And often when these fee title properties are up here on the coast, they're extremely valuable and coveted because they don't have any restrictions or regulations or guidelines that they have to adhere to from the ejidos. So having kind of given you that background on a little bit of background, let's go back to 1994 when the Mitsubishi Corporation, in partnership with the Mexican government, began the application, the permitting process, to build the world's largest industrial salt facility on the northern shore of Laguna San Ignacio. It would cover 116 square miles. I'll have a schematic of it in one of the next slides. But it becomes this big battle, and it's over a very special place, UNESCO World Heritage Site, the last pristine gray whale birthing lagoon left on the planet, a million-acre wetland complex. And it's surrounded, that million acres is comprised of six of these ejidos and one area of national lands. So what did it look like? You see on the top here, the key to this thing, the same company, Exportadora de Sal, which is Mitsubishi, was already operating a facility north of here in Scammon's Lagoon, in Ojo de Liebre. And at the time, in the mid-1990s, was when the Asian economies, the Asian tigers, were really going through the roof. And a lot of the salt wasn't going to reach any tables. It was going to petrochemical that the Asian tigers were calling for. And the big advantage that the site in San Ignacio, besides already producing these naturally occurring process of wind and sun producing salt, was this thing here. Just offshore here at Punta Abrojos, there's deep water. The operation in Ojo de Liebre requires them to double handle the salt. Comes off conveyors, it's loaded onto low draft barges, goes out to Isla Cedros, transported onto Trans-Pacific ships, and off they go. Here they were going to be able to bring those ships in, load up, and off we go. The other problem here was that this was a big pathway for the migrating gray whales, annual migrating gray whales. So what happens? When the fight goes off, there's some folks at the lagoon, Javier Villavicencio, Isidro Arce, Raul Lopez, José de Varela, Serge Dedina is there with his wife doing his PhD field research. And all these folks start, Alfonso Aguirre is another important name, and all these folks start saying, hey, there's this big project proposed for the lagoon, we need to do something. And in come in the big environmental groups, NRDC, IFA. On the Mexican side, you had Homero Origis with the Grupo de los Cien, and his top gun, a very good friend of mine, Rodrigo Jara, is a brilliant attorney. You'll hear a little bit more about him. And the fight goes on, becomes a two-pronged battle. On the one hand, you have the propaganda war, and it basically pits cute baby gray whales versus evil Japanese corporation. Gray whales win all the time. I bet on it. Go to Vegas on that one. On the other side, you have a very complex and bitterly fought battle that goes up, winds its way through the courts, and goes to the Supreme Court twice. On the second time up, the Supreme Court says, we're not biologists, we're not experts, we're going to put together a blue ribbon panel of globally recognized experts. One of those gentlemen that was on that panel was Paul Dayton, professor emeritus at Scripps Institute of Oceanography. And he would tell me this story later, that once they started working, it was very clear to them, based on the existing laws at the time and the environmental impact assessment as submitted, that the committee was going to vote, this blue ribbon panel was going to vote, recommend approving the project. So a very critical time. It's very clear that this is going to happen. But what takes place? Folks from the lagoon invite the president of Mexico at the time, Ernesto Zedillo, to please come and take a look at what's happening. What's at stake? And he takes them up on the offer. And for folks that have never been to the lagoon, it's this beautiful, stark place. It can be really windy, it can be a little bit cold, but just amazing place, just amazing, amazing place. So the president flies into Laguna San Ignacio, steps off the plane. It's warm and sunny, calm winds, the beers are cold, the food is warm, people are friendly, they go out on the boats, and they have this amazing experience. And if you ever visit the lagoon, and you happen to go to, stay at Koyima Ecotourism, where you can stop by just to see it if you're interested, in their guest book, you can go back March 2000, and there's the president of Mexico, signs in, it's like everybody else. So on March 2nd, he flies back to Mexico City, and on March 2nd, by executive order, cancels the project. And he prohibits, in his executive order, he prohibits Mexican state actors from moving the project forward. It was a 51% Mexican government project. But remember that term, Mexican state actors, because it comes back to haunt. So out of this fight come some of the biggest, or some of the most influential kind of leaders that would make critical decisions in the coming years in Baja California. Joel Reynolds does a fantastic job in leading the opposition at the NRDC. And he was already a senior attorney for NRDC, and he really cements his place at a global scale. Does a fantastic job in his fight. Rodrigo Jara in Mexico, another brilliant attorney. Mark Spalding, who would go on to teach at the University of California and helps restart years later the organization called Pro Peninsula. And the other one is Serge Dedina, a friend of mine, that I, fellow guy that grew up in Imperial Beach. I've known him since we're in junior high. Grew up surfing together, went to school together. And during that time, Sej would become the Northwest Region Director for the Nature Conservancy. But the big thing is victory. I put that down with a question mark, because the president in his executive order makes that very interesting comment. The other thing that not a lot of people know about this battle was that 4 months after this victory, after March 2nd, the Secretary of the Interior, through the Mining Ministry, receives an application for a new 50-year mining concession from Exportadora de Sal, Mitsubishi. And that application is approved 4 months later. Nobody knows about this. Even I don't know about it at this time. And so once there's this big party in Abrilhos, everybody's jumping up and down. We did it. Fantastic. And then the big NGOs leave, and the locals say, hey, where'd everybody go? And to this day, there's still kind of this, I think there was a miscommunication or misunderstanding on what the roles and what the future was going to hold for these communities. Because for the big NGOs, they were there to protect the economic base of these communities. But for the local people in Abrilhos, in the lagoon, and the other communities, in the other ejidos, Emiliano Zapata, they all thought that these people would be there and stay in partnership and help these communities grow. So just something interesting to note. And while this happens, in the mid-1990s, in Costa Rica, and this will be pretty clear here in a second, is during the 1990s is when we really start to understand the role of rainforests. And so the Costa Rican government had already declared the whole darn country a national park. They're protecting their rainforest. They're doing a fantastic job. But what they'd created were paper parks. They declared these areas to protect rainforest, critical rainforest areas, but they weren't functioning. The parks weren't functioning. And so these three guys, Pete Seligman, who would go on to become the executive director of Conservation International, David Yonkman, who I highly asterisk there because he becomes a good friend of mine and an important figure later on in the story, and a gentleman named Brian Halziel. And they take a look at Costa Rica and they say, well, these guys have done a fantastic job in declaring this, but what are the problems? Here are the solutions. And they go find funding. And they go to the national park directors and the president of Costa Rica and they say, fantastic job, here's your solution. Costa Rica gets shot off in this. Now they're like environmental leaders in management, protection. But how does that relate to Baja? As I said, Serge Dedina would become the Northwest Region Director for Nature Conservancy. And after this success, Nature Conservancy, these three guys say, going, where else can we do this? Where else can we do this? And it just so happens that Baja California in the central desert has two massive parks, Valle de los Sirios and the Vizcaino Biosphere Reserve. And lo and behold, when they took a look at these things, they were paper parks with the exact same problems. And so Parks in Peril, Costa Rica, scratch that, Parks in Peril, Baja California. And Sej comes in and wows them with this fantastic program. Within a year, Sej leaves the Nature Conservancy and starts his own organization along with Jay Nichols. And they'd be co-executive directors. Jay would be charged with directing wildlife efforts, basically turtles. And Serge Dedina would be charged with land and coastal protection. And he had chosen four sites. In the north, Bahia de Los Angeles, Laguna San Ignacio, Bahia Concepcion, and Bahia Magdalena. At this time, I'm still lifeguarding. And I see my friend Storm's organization. I start volunteering for him immediately. I want to be a part of this. I love this place. I've been all over it. I know every dirt road, surfed all over. And so I want to help. The Grupo Tortuguero, for the first 2 years, do a fantastic job in growth. The foundations love them. They love that effort. It's a highly charismatic animal. The energy at the annual meetings, just fantastic. And so great work. 15 years of work has shown it. And the other thing that happens early on is ProNatura approaches Wild Coast to form a partnership in land conservation efforts. And that quickly materializes. At the same time all this is happening, we begin to get we get pounded on the head with a massive government building project known as the Escaleta Nautica. And I'll show a slide of that in a second. But basically, the Mexican government wanted to build 27 resort marinas circumnavigating the peninsula and the mainland side of the Gulf. And the idea was that you had 52,000 boats trapped in the marinas up here in Southern California. And if we just build these marinas, suddenly we'd have this parade, a constant parade of yachts moving and a million nautical tourists. And just numbers that just didn't make any sense. So when the partnership between ProNatura and Wild Coast forms, the big thing that ProNatura was bringing to the table was an initiative to build, to establish a marine protected area in the Midriff Island region, the Sea of Cortez. And so we traveled to Bahía de Los Ángeles. At the time, a gentleman named Antonio Resendiz Fantastic sea turtle researcher, had lived at in Bahia de Los Angeles many years along with his wife, still has a camp there, raised his sons there. He's the president of the Ejido. The real estate boom and the market pressure over lands hadn't occurred yet. So it's this very special moment. And we go there, and the two directors, Pronatura and Wild Coast, present the Marine Park Initiative. And when Antonio, the president of the Ejido, the first thing that he says to us is, for us, our marine resources, our fisheries are in decline. The town's in trouble. For us, conservation has to generate income streams. And so when I hear that, me, I'm a lands guy, my ears go, yeah, let's talk to this guy. When we do the debrief, when we come back to San Diego and Ensenada, we can do a debrief on our trip. Myself and Miguel Vargas say, let's do a lands deal. Let's do a lands deal. Because one of the things that's vitally important about a marine protected area, especially in these areas where you got very heavy coastal influence, one of the components is land protection, coastal protection. The other one is sustainable development or build out for their towns, sustainable fisheries management plan. So a whole host of other things that you can't just build a marine park and expect it to function. And in fact, just on that note real quick, since the establishment of the Upper Gulf and the Midriff, both those parks are maintaining status quo. There's been no improvement in biomass or fisheries. So a lot of work needs to be done up here. So me as a lands guy, it's like, well, okay, I'll help with the marine park. I'll also help Jay with the turtles. And then this very interesting person walks in, Jeff White from Northern California, into the office, and he's holding this very, very strange contract. But before we go there, it's important to talk about the Escaleta Náutica. And there's the mess that they wanted to create. 27 resort marinas, everything was going to be supposed to be like one day sail away, get to Ensenada, get to Colonel, there's nothing here. There's no infrastructure, there's no roads, nothing. And the two linchpins, the two keystone projects of these 27 was going to be Santa Rosalita, where boats would come from Southern California. It would come into Santa Rosalita. It would go in these big, expensive sailboats. They'd put them onto specialized trailers. They would go through one of the windiest sections of Baja, overland, and drop you off in LA Bay, and suddenly you're cruising the Midriff Island region. Kind of harebrained, but it created a huge boom in real estate and land speculation. Massive. And to make matters worse, the project was all permitted via a regional impact assessment. Basically said, oh, these are going to be the permit. These are going to be the, they never talk about any specifics in any different climates or environments. So let's go back to Jeff White. Jeff White walks in with this very interesting contract over the, over the Bahia Concepcion Peninsula. It's 125,000 acres, nothing on it, spectacular. Sea turtle nesting site. Some of the best fishing in Baja is just offshore here. And it's part of a million acre Ejido La Purisima. There's 385 people at the time. There was these big heavy factions and they all hated each other. The ranchers hated the developers and everybody. It was like this big mess. And what the Ejido La Purisima wanted to do, it was also an Escaleta Náutica site. So the community, a group of 385 people, wanted to break the lease with Jeff and start selling property. The problem is it's an interesting contract because at the time it was on very shaky legal grounds because it's done for a vast amount of acreage directly with an American citizen. He signed it in 1990. He was paying $7,000 a year as lease payment. And beginning in 2000, they begin to reject the $7,000 in hopes of breaking the lease. When he comes to us, the first thing we do is, thanks to the fantastic work of Roberto Carmona, a bird specialist from the University of Baja California Sur, puts together this fantastic team. I'm joined by Hoyt Peckham of the Grupo Tortuguero and also a Wild Coast guy from the wildlife side. And we go out and we spend almost 2 weeks jumping, climbing, swimming, doing all kinds, just making these incredible trips. Like every day we just go out, 12 hours later we'd meet back, get some food, drink some water, tell a few stories, and then go to sleep because we were just exhausted. So we come up with this assessment, but we still have that interesting contract. And what we do is we decide it's too shaky to defend on its own. So what we do is we set up a Mexican shell corporation, and we transfer the lease rights to this corporation. So So we kind of straighten it up, get some footing. We hire an attorney. We say, defend this at all costs. And that legal fight goes into the courts, and it starts getting a little expensive. And then once we let him bleed, once the bleeding was going on a little bit, me and Miguel Vargas travel to the Ejido La Purísima, and we meet with the newly elected officers of the Ejido. And we say, well, we understand you guys are in a nasty fight with that bad corporation, but we're interested in it as well. And if we can resolve that issue, will you guys deal with us in good faith? Because if we don't, then the fight goes back on. And so we end up striking this discussion, series of discussions, negotiating team, and we come up with, here are the numbers. For the 125,000 acres, conservation easements over the entire 125, $12 an acre, $1.5 million. Great deal. So we go and present this. When you do a deal with one of these ejidos, it has to be voted on by the entirety of the membership. So we go, we present it to the ejido, and everybody's in favor of it, but a common thread starts happening. Is people say, why just there? We have 1 million acres. We go up over the Sierra, like the spine of the Baja Peninsula, and we drop down over the Pacific side. We want the whole thing. So we go back to the negotiating table, and we come up with this agreement. We drop the price $7.25 per acre. And the way that the deal was going to set up is we were going to divide this land cooperative into four parts, 250,000 acres each. When the first one was signed, there would also be a $1 million signing bonus, so we're at $2 million, and then we go on from there. When the last of the four were signed, there would be a conservation trust fund set up for the community. So there'd be an annuity going in for educational grants for their kids, medicinal grants for the elderly, anything they wanted related to the community, it would be okay to use those funds. And it's the first time that I start thinking about trust funds. This would also play an important role later on. So we've got this great agreement. We go present it, we get the vote, and so now we're one signature away. The president of the Ejido La Purísima is authorized to sign. Me and Miguel Vargas come back, we're jumping up and down for joy. Miguel's letting his folks at ProNatura, at the region level, at the national level in Mexico City. I go and tell my director, Serge Dedina, they okay the second agreement, and the deal falls apart. When we come back from that trip, I put together a memorandum outlining the agreement and basically laying out a timeline. And I hand it to my director. I go back to my workspace. He comes in a few minutes later, and he says, I'm not sending this up. And I'm like, Sej, we've been working on this for almost a year and a half. Throughout the process, you've been telling me, go, go, go. The foundations are ready to fund this. To this day, nobody knows why that happened. The deal falls. Miguel Vargas ProNatura is almost fired. Our reputation as conservation NGOs goes down the tubes. And who comes in and buys the place? Carlos Slim, world's richest man. And this kind of debacle, this tragedy, I refer to it as the ghost of Bahía Concepción. Because from this moment on, Wild Coast partner ProNatura would refuse to deal in real numbers, in big numbers. And just a tragedy. And so if that wasn't bad enough, we still got the Escaleta Náutica and all this land, real estate market going all over the place. And working with Rodrigo Jara, Fernando Ochoa, Miguel Vargas, Gustavo Donovan, we put together a lawsuit. And at the same time, there was a study commissioned by the marine consulting firm EDA. And EDA usually is a client of marine developers, of marina developers. People go to them and they go, can we do this? And so when they do their report, they basically crunch the numbers of this massive project. And when they come out with their report, the EDA report indicates that the Mexican government had overestimated their potential financial market by 600%. So not a little bit, 600. The lawsuit combined with that report, John McCarthy of Fonatur and the president are forced to publicly pull the project. The interesting thing that happens, though, is that 6 months later, they rebrand it, and the map almost looks alike. This time, it's an independent budget, but nothing has come of it. And so then, also in 2002, my director decides to hold a a media event in Abreojos, and it was designed to promote the idea that surfers and folks in Baja California were opposed to the Escaleta Nautica. A good friend of mine that was an AP reporter at the time and his editor agreed to do the story. So we traveled down and we have this great surf contest, and we just happened to do the timing so that we'd have it coincide with one of the sea turtle monitoring sessions. So we get these two guys out, the reporter and his photographer, and they get to go pull turtles, an amazing experience. And one of the things, one of the big strategies that we used to do with fishers as well was the photographer had told us that he had a daughter, young daughter. And this is what we did with fishers as well, to kind of hook them, get the hook in them. Whenever we pulled a turtle that hadn't been tagged, we'd collect all the data. And then the last line that we'd fill out would be name. And so we'd say, hey, if it was a fisher, we'd go, hey, Francisco, what's your daughter's name? And we'd write that name down. And that fisher would go down and tell his family, and then they were in. And so, good event. Good event, two stories go from the AP International. When I get back, I'm fired. And so I would leave Wild Coast Conservation. I'd go back to the beach and lifeguarding, kind of angry and bitter, but so it goes. In 2003, ProNatura and Wild Coast begin to realize that they'd made a mistake in not dealing with the land conservation issue in the Midriff Island region in Bahia de Los Angeles. And so they put together a land conservation initiative can we get an AV guy to, oh, there we go, okay, good. And so ProNatura is very good at doing baseline studies, the justifications. But what happens is this thing appears. And so a very good idea, very, very good justification for it. But when the project comes out, there's two things that happen. In these critical areas that get identified, there's five key priority sites along 130-mile stretch of coast in the Midriff. And ProNatura decides to only, let's say we've got a nesting beach, they would only account or try to attempt to target 30% of that to protect it, 20% of it. And the reason they were doing that was they were trying to keep the numbers down. The other thing they do is that the financial incentive that they're offering the community is way too low. By this time, a hectare of land in Bahía de Los Ángeles in a prime location was going over $100,000. The incentives for conservation easements were on average about a tenth of that. And people would tell me from these communities, they would say, look, Aaron, I love that place. I love that place 70 miles away. I used to go there and fish with my dad. I own it. My family's owned it. But it doesn't do anything for me. And so I need to send my kid, and oftentimes this is the problem in these outlying areas. There's no high schools. There's no schools. So you want a better future for your kid, and the thing that you have is land. So by the end of 2003, the folks in Ejido Echeverria, the southern shore of Laguna San Ignacio, get in touch with Miguel Vargas of ProNatura, their lands guy. And they say, hey, we're hearing a lot of stuff from the Mexican government. They're interested in coming in and maybe taking away our concession, putting high-end tourism facilities for whale watching in Laguna San Ignacio. And we want to talk a deal. And this is the 157,000 acres on the southern shore of Laguna San Ignacio. For a year, I didn't talk to my ex-friend. Didn't talk to him. I'd run across him. We both surfed the same beach. I'd be on the beach, and Wild Coast office is right across the street. And one day, coming out of the lifeguard dispatch, and he's sitting there at the foot of the pier. And I'm on a time limit. I got to get in the truck to do patrols. So I'm walking by, and he says, Aaron, can I talk to you? Want to apologize. I was wrong. We've got this very interesting project, and you're the man to do it. So at first, I'm uncertain, and I agree to sign. I sign a consulting contract so that I could get out if I needed to. And I signed that contract, and I begin working again with my old friends at ProNatura, with Miguel Vargas and Fernando Ochoa. And as I'm coming in, the wildlife side, everybody on the wildlife side is being pushed out, including the Grupo Tortuguero. And they would be quickly picked up by an organization called ProPeninsula that was directed at the time by Cam Adine and Chris Pacenti. and they would do good work with the grupo in helping it grow. So what's happening in 2003 at Laguna San Ignacio? The federal government and the National Tourism Board, FONATUR, were considering a cruise ship terminal once again right here. And the pier is a mile-long pier. When did we see a mile-long pier? Like 4 years ago with the Mitsubishi Corporation. The thing they want to do here on the southern shore is develop high-end tourism. This is where the ejido that contacted Pronatura is. And one of the things that was discussed at the national level was potentially expropriating lands for these projects. So the folks there in the lagoon, the other thing that's quite prevalent, if you visit the lagoon and you go slowly on the dirt roads, you'll see all these Pemex benchmarks. He's got Pemex, a national petroleum company, has done extensive benchmark testing, and there's something there, natural gas and oil reserves. So they reach out, and this leads to the Laguna San Ignacio Conservation Alliance. And what we did was the original footprint of the project was this ejido here. This is the ejido Luis Echeverria in blue. And that's what Pronatura wanted to do. And when I looked at it, I'm like, oh, well, yeah, that's great, you know, southern shore. But, you know, what about, like, this mountain range that feeds into the lagoon? What about these salt flats and these neighboring mountain ranges? I was able to ultimately get these two land cooperatives, massive land cooperatives in, and this one, Baturi. This area right here accounts for a small portion of the ejido Emiliano Zapata. And if you remember in the slide, the schematic, that's where the evaporation ponds were for the Mitsubishi project. So it's a little ghost of Bahia Concepcion, because Pronatura is trying to cut corners and make it smaller. And so once we start negotiating with these fantastic folks from the ejido Echeverria, Raul Lopez, Ocele de Varela, Manuel Gardea, the rest of the folks here at the lagoon, they're committed to this agreement. And the agreement was that we would put conservation easements over the entire ejido in exchange for legal defense and then the financials. When we started talking about, okay, how much are we going to offer? On the one hand, we had Pronatura and the ghost of Bahia Concepcion on one side. And then when we would visit the lagoon, I'd wake up early, grab my cup of coffee, and go for a walk, and then just start like pulling hair out because I was going. Nobody knew what the offer was going to be, what the local expectation was. Because after all, what is the last pristine gray whale birthing lagoon on the planet worth? And so I asked Raul Lopez to throw out the first number. Just so we get an idea of what the expectation is of you as the ejido leaders. And in an almost kind of embarrassed way, he says, is $50,000 too much to permanently encumber all their lands? And I say, stop right there, we're not going to do that. And from that moment on, Wild Coast, Pronatura, and the ejido Echeverria would become partners. And because we'd all be looking out for each other and making sure that we came out with the best deal to present to the foundations. So we do this in a very short period of time. We start in January in earnest. By summer, we've got the agreement. We've got it. And we start putting together the contracts. We start shopping the proposal. We start vetting the foundations. And we stall. The money starts to kind of hesitate. And some of it was legitimate. One of the things that happens is that the foundation start asking for due diligence. So they say, okay, we want to hire a prestigious law firm in Mexico City to review the project. We want to do a land tenure study, feasibility study. We're like, fine, we'll help out. Anything we can do to help you out. And so by 2005, we reached 2005, the next whale watching season. And it provides us with a little bit of breathing room, because at that time, there's so much activity with the whale watching that it gave us a little breather. We said, okay, look, we're going to pull back a little bit, and we're going to, in the spring, after the season, we'll continue and finish this thing up. During that period, I made it very clear that the Pronatura, the partners of Pronatura, they don't believe us. They do not believe us. And so we needed to reach out. And so what I decided to do is talk to NRDC. And I talked to Jacob Scherer, their international programs director, and Joel Reynolds. And the first thing that I say when I talk to him, I say, look, we've got this very interesting project to permanently protect the lagoon, and Mitsubishi's part of it. And he goes, no, it's not. We killed it. And I go, no, you didn't. He goes, yes, we did. And then so I send him the executive order of President Zedillo. I send him the valid mining concession of Mitsubishi. And a third incident happens. Each year, NRDC takes folks, groups to the lagoon to do whale watching. On one of the trips, almost when this is happening, Joel is set to take a trip with a group from NRDC. And who does he run into at the airport? Nobody else but Juan Bremer, the project director of Mitsubishi in Laguna San Ignacio. And they immediately recognize each other, and they throw little jabs at each other, verbal jabs. And as they're about to go their separate ways to catch their planes, Juan says to Joel, it's like, hey, Joel, you're going to Lagoon, right? Yeah. It's like, yeah, so are we. This time we're going to take it. Joel grabs his cell phone, calls me up, says, we need to talk. NRDC is not a land conservation outfit. So they said, we're going to bring in a gentleman named Kim Elliman, Rockefeller grandson. He did the financing and significant amount of work on the Walden Pond Conservation Project back east. And so I begin to communicate with Joel, Jacob, and Kim in setting up the logistics for the trip. At the same time that this is happening, Ken Weiss of the LA Times gets interested in the story. And so Ken wanted to see the project team in the field negotiating real things. He didn't want anything staged. I said, you got it. We're transparent. I'm willing to put everything on the line. If it gets nasty, nothing good. We'll deal with it. So I scheduled the two trips right together. As the date approaches, I put in a cash advance to my director. And for the first time ever, he says, no cash. And I'm going, well, I have to go because Kim Elliman is the key to getting NRDC in. And if NRDC is in the alliance, we've got it. Because I don't want you anywhere near there. So I didn't go. NRDC wasn't happy. When Kim Elliman and Jacob Scherer are going to leave the lagoon, there's a big windstorm, so they couldn't leave. Flight couldn't leave. They fly back to San Diego, and they have to spend the night. And that night, when I leave the Wild Coast office, just by chance, I grab the Wild Coast the laptop with all the information on it. And who happens to call me when they come into San Diego? Jacob Scherer and Kim Elliman, and I have a great talk with them. And that leads, ultimately, to NRDC joining the alliance. Critical moment, critical, critical moment. And thanks to the leadership of Jacob and Joel and their members in raising hundreds of thousands of dollars in a very short period of time, by June of 2005, we come to this very, very critical meeting. We call for all the foundation directors to meet at the offices of NRDC here in Santa Monica. There was five issues that were holding them up. On the Monday that the meeting was set for Wednesday. Monday, I traveled to Ensenada, and the project team, all we do is just study. Start putting together the PowerPoint for that presentation. Tuesday, another long day studying and finalizing the PowerPoint and putting together the information packets for the directors. And Joel, at the meeting, we go through all the issues. Joel takes over. He says, we start our campaign. We expect to raise over $1 million for the first phase alone of this project. Then he pulls all the foundation directors, and they're all in. Fantastic. Me and Miguel Vargas, after the thing, there's tears of joy that are welling up in my eyes. We go out on the balcony out there in the little conference, off the conference room, and we wouldn't let go of each other. We're just giving this hug that we did it. Fantastic, we did it. 2 days later, I'm fired again. 2 months, I go back to lifeguarding. I'm on the beach. I was invited to the signing ceremony, and I didn't want to go because I didn't want to go there and do something stupid. So I'm on the beach. I'm listening to NPR, and lots of people take credit. But that doesn't end my involvement in Baja California. On to the story of Bahía de los Ángeles, Midriff Island region, Sea of Cortez, key site of the Escaleta Náutica, and it's the Ejido Tierra Libertad, 1 million acres, 130 miles of coast. Here in blue, that's the Ejido Tierra Libertad. Bahía de los Ángeles is located right here. This is the Nature Conservancy spot analysis. So each square represents high biodiversity areas recognized by the computer analysis. So you see all these squares? Everything's popping up, just lighting up. And as I talked about before, some of the big upwelling vertical mix, highest productivity, top priority for conservation. It includes 18 wetlands along the stretch. Just an absolute jewel. The other thing, let me go back to that real quick. The other thing that's happened over the years with fishing, especially in the Midriff Island region, is that over here, the fishers from over here, especially in Bahia Kino, have fished out their area, especially their artisanal fishers. So for at least since 2000, you've had hundreds of boats coming across the Gulf and illegally fishing over here. It's really targeted. And last October, I was there, and there had to be 250, 300 boats working Sierra indiscriminately, just hammering away. So there's these absolutely beautiful places. Very important as a nexus, this interchange of energy between the Gulf and land. And they're all in play. They're all, like I said earlier, anywhere there's something beautiful, they're parcellas, and parcellas are up for sale. So what were the big benchmarks that Wild Coast and Pro Natura did? In 2000, they start the initiative to declare a National Marine Park, which gets declared as a biosphere reserve, not a national park. National parks are the highest level of protection accorded by the Mexican government. Biospheres are the second level. And the interesting thing, the big shift there is that biospheres open up legal mechanisms for resource extraction. So a little dangerous, but still a very wonderful feat that Gustavo Donovan was able to achieve. And in 2003, they begin to address that error of not negotiating early for lands. It's an important component of a successful marine protected area, but they were facing a high level of real estate and land values, development pressure. So what went wrong? Again, the initial strategy only focused on the marine protected area. By this time, the foundations had now seen the San Ignacio model of setting up, in exchange for ejido-wide conservation easements, setting up trust funds. But here you had a situation that was different, because you had this incredible amount of development pressure and real estate values that you'd have to set up a giant trust fund, just a monstrous trust fund, and it just was not feasible. And because of that, and the ghost of Bahia Concepcion appears again, and the values and the incentives are not good enough. And ultimately, they didn't adapt to the changing circumstances that they were facing. And this all leaves Bahia de Los Angeles in jeopardy. Meanwhile, I'm lifeguarding. So in 2005, about mid-2005, same time that I'm out of Wild Coast, a new ejido president comes in, and a gentleman from Tijuana, a businessman, and highly pro-development. And the way that he got in is with these land cooperatives, there are these existing rights. They're ejido rights, membership rights. And one way that you can become is you can inherit an existing membership right, you can be voted in by the membership, or you can just go buy a membership from some old guy. And so that's what happened. The new president comes in. It's reported, I'd never confirmed, but it's the deal that supposedly the rumor says $100,000. The guy shows up, $100,000 cash, give me your ejido membership. And he gave up millions. So a group of attorneys led by a woman named Gloria Adame shows up in mid-2005, high-powered stuff. They rep a big law firm in Mexico City. And they offer $1.4 billion for the million acres. That's $17.5 million per member of the ejido. The folks in Bahia Los Angeles are all jumping up for joy. Some stop working. They're all dreaming about what color Hummer they're going to buy, when they're going to move to Beverly Hills or Paris or whatever. It becomes this big mess. Wild Coast and Pro Natura at this time, they didn't believe in the offer either. I didn't think it was feasible. They didn't either, but their strategy was to leave. They left, thinking that the project would fall out of its own weight, it was just not feasible, and that they would return and pick up the pieces and offer conservation easements. But by this time, there was so much development pressure that these were the leading sharks. But there was other real moderate and large-scale developers lurking. So by April, the end of April 2006, members of the land cooperative get a hold of me, and they say, can you come down and talk to us? We want to know what you think. So I take a few days off from lifeguarding, and I travel down my favorite peninsula, and we start talking. And I say, $1.4 billion is too much. It's too much. You can get it for a lot cheaper. Why offer that much money? And if it was legitimate, in order to get a return on investment within a reasonable amount of time, you'd have to build a city overnight to generate that much economic activity to get a just didn't pencil out. So at the end of this discussion with the community, they knew that I'd led, that I was part of the San Ignacio effort. And they say, well, you did San Ignacio, and can you put a proposal to us to act as a counter? And I say, if you want $1 billion, forget it, I'm out of here. But if we want to talk, we can talk. Let's play Monopoly money. And I say, conservation easements over the entire, everything you guys have. And what if I brought in $500,000 per person? That's a $40 million deal. They go, no. And then I say, $750,000. They go, no. And then I say the magic number, $1 million. Everybody says yes. So $80 million, for, in my opinion, it's worth it. It's this is an incredible place. High for Mexican standards, but it's important, it's incumbent upon us and important for us to recognize not only that we, like as me as a conservationist or biologist, or that we cherish these places, we say how important they are, but we have to compete. If we're going to protect these areas, we have to compete. And that was an expectation, and at $80 an acre, I thought it was reasonable. So I send out some feelers to the foundation supporting efforts in Baja, and they say, no way. ProNatura and Wild Coast, by this time, are lobbying against me. It's like, Aaron's carpetbagger. He should get out of there. He doesn't know what he's talking about. But I wasn't there because I wanted to. The Ejido asked me for help. And so we're in this situation where we're caught between a rock and a hard place. And in effect, this place and the models that I'd done, the deal in Bahía Concepción, the deal in San Ignacio, there were these models that were supposed to be duplicated, that we could duplicate in other land cooperatives. And something was missing, something that I'd been thinking about for a long time. Because in Mexico, you get a couple of traditional paths. One is unregulated urban sprawl, becomes a big mess, growth, no infrastructure, environmental impacts. The biggest example, and I love the place, I have family there, is Tijuana. Big place that huge impacts. The second one is the Fonatur model, Cancun, Acapulco, and these are big economic successes. Short term they work because they account for everybody. But as I said before, you get a lot of poverty. You get this dramatic poverty in Mexico, and anywhere there's strong economic activities, people just come running. One example of that I know the numbers for is in Tijuana during kind of the low point in the economic downturn. That Tijuana in the Baja California Peninsula has one of the highest standards of living in Mexico. And other parts of Mexico, in Tijuana, on a per month basis, there was 25 to 30,000 in-migrants to the Tijuana area. So 25,000 people, over almost in a month, you'd have a new city, a new town. And so this happens in all these areas. And they ultimately end up consuming. But one of the things that I always thought about is, like, why are we in the environmental community or conservation, why are we always waiting? For 70 years, these ejidos were trapped. The scientists were telling us they're fantastic, they're beautiful, they're it's incredible, their biological importance on a global scale is right there, and we just let them sit. And we wait for these calamities to happen, a big nasty project, and these communities have been waiting for 70 years for this. And by this point, they say, I mean, guys in LA Bay would tell me, like I said, I go, they love that wetland down there. We own it, but my outboard's broken. My car's broken. I need to pay for university for my kid. And so they knew that I said, my job is to win, is to come with a better deal for you. If I don't, it's fine. Send me the contracts of land sales. I'll send them to Mexico City for review just to make sure you don't get cheated. And so I start developing this idea with David Yonkman again, the guy that was down there in Costa Rica, and I'm become very good friends, and we do this alternative development plan, the sustainable development plan for Bahía de Los Angeles, where, in effect, the plan was to use 1% of the land, lock up 99%. Change is coming to Bahía de Los Angeles, period. It is coming. And at this time, there's still, when I'm doing this in 2006 to 2008, there's still time to save it. And there's those five priority areas that are out there. And the idea was that we would create this in partnership with the local community, give them a 15% equity on top of the $80 million. Here's a kind of funny story. When I first start talking to Scripps, Hubs, and the universities, the first person I go talk to is Paul Dayton of Scripps Institute. And the other person there is Ed Parnell. And when I go talk to him, I'm like walk into the offices and I introduce myself and I start talking about the project and this idea of master plan sustainable development over 1%, 99% conservation outputs. And I'm ready to like run, because when you start talking about development to a biologist, they hate it. But these guys understood that we're late in the game. And so new models, new approaches had to take place. And so these two gentlemen at Scripps sign on. Chuck Baxter at Hubs Marine Research Station, another big name in marine conservation and biology, signs up. The two professors from the two universities and researchers from the two universities in Baja California, UMass, the Urban Studies and Geography departments, both come on board. ETEC International, which is a one of the leading alternative energy consultants in the world, and on and on and on. We had this great team, and we're putting this together, this proposal, to go back to the foundations, try to get some seed money to make this thing happen. In April 30th, 2008, members of the community that I've been working with in Valle de los Ancos come up to San Diego, and I give them a lot of credit for doing this. They come up and give me the news face-to-face. 2.4 of the five sites that we were trying to protect, gone. So the project ends. I have nothing to offer the foundations or the... And the big question is, would it have worked? Based on the alternative that's coming, I sure would have liked to have given it a shot. And I think it would have worked, ultimately. So where does this leave us, ultimately? Sea of Cortez, it's heavily damaged, decades of impacts, but it's still recoverable. And the key thing here is stopping the race for fish. You've got commercial fishers competing with artisanal fishers, competing with sport fishers. And the way to do that, there's global examples. And even in Baja, there's one. On the Pacific side, you have the cooperatives, dedicated access, catch limits of the Pacific spiny lobster. One example that I'm very close to the people in Punta Abrojos, last year, I think their total catch was bought beforehand by Korean interests for $7 million. You go to that town, it's orderly, there's no trash. The guys come home from fishing, they take a shower, they clean up, they hang out with their kids, help start a lifeguard program there. And the other thing that's happened is that guys that retire from the fishing cooperative get a retirement. So it's this way of like creating this community interest, they create stakeholders. And on the Pacific side, the other thing that happens is you have self-policing. And there's a very heavy hand for poachers. If they catch them, they're dealt with very harshly by fellow fishers in the co-ops. And so there's great examples of fishers getting it right. But we still have that situation that heavily damaged Gulf. And then you combine it now with these key lands that were lost, all these coastal lands that were lost. And what these represent, Valle de los Ángeles right now, it used to be a little seed, a little seedling. Now it's starting to grow. There's more interest. There's more buyers. Right now, there's nothing to direct it or help it grow in a sustainable manner. Eventually, it's too beautiful. It has too much development potential that eventually there will be a city there. There will be a city. But it's not too late. It's not too late. If we can shake that ghost and start dealing with people in an earnest manner that represents real land values and provides a brighter future. And so I use the word in the title, The Fall of the Sea of Cortez, for two reasons. One, it could be late in the calendar year and there's spring coming after a dark period, or it could be fallen and it could be over. But ultimately, it's up to us as all stakeholders, as you, as individuals, in pressuring and getting in contact with your NGOs. And I'd like to thank you very much for coming out tonight.